Evening. Yes, me too. I've got my cough drops up here and my water and my water bottle, so hopefully I will make it through okay. Well, there's no place like home, as Dorothy said so aptly some time ago. Is anybody here for the first time tonight? Welcome. Anybody else? Okay, great. I'm Kathy. And my little opening comment is referring to the fact that I've been away for 3 months. I just got back 19 days ago. And as I guess most of you know, I was up at Tassajara, up at the monastery. And so I want to talk about my experience. I thought you might want to hear.
Yes.
About how, I don't know how I can possibly talk about it, but of course I'm going to. I think I'd like to start by just briefly kind of describing a typical day, especially maybe for those of you who haven't been there or who aren't quite clear about, well, what'd you do up there? I want to demystify it a little bit. And then I really want to talk about Zazen, believe it or not. And then whatever else you want to talk about. So I do have a clock here, thanks to Jean, and I'll make sure we have enough time that you can ask if there's anything you'd like to hear about or any questions you have. I want to make sure that there's time to do that. So my alarm would go off about 3:30 in the morning. And those of you who know me know that I absolutely don't like getting up that early. So my deal with myself was, I'm going to drink a lot of coffee before Zazen. And if I can drink a lot of good, strong coffee, by gum, I'll do it. And I'll do it every morning. And I did. I did. I followed the schedule. And I'm not ashamed to appreciate the coffee and the role of the coffee. And one of the great things about having that commitment to myself was that every morning I got to, I had a heated room because I'm over 50. If you're over 50, you get a heated room. So I had a heated room, and so I would be cozy in my little room, but then I would take my down and my hat and everything, because the minute I'd step out the door, you know, I'd be hit by whatever the temperature of the morning was. And in the, you know, in September it really wasn't very cold, but of course October, the sun starts leaving the canyon, it starts getting pretty cold. So there was always, that was the, one of the first things every morning was, oh, how cold is it going to be? And, you know, to be prepared with my hat and my coat. And then I would go down the stairs and I would go to, there's this big thing called the samovar, and it's this big, like, furnace of water. And they have spigots. So I would stand there and I would, it took a while to make drip my coffee because I made such a big pitcher every morning. So it would take about 10 minutes and I would look up at the stars. And, you know, every morning I was, there was Orion, there was the Big Dipper, there were the Pleiades, you know, and I got to watch how they moved over the 3 month period. So, you know, there I was right away, even though, you know, I had been so afraid of that early morning wake up. Oh, no, it's going to be so hard. I'm standing there going, this is great. Look at this. Look where I am. When do I get to do this? You know, when do I get to stand and just bear witness to this beautiful planet that we live on? And then there would be little adventures with the spotted skunks, which don't spray as readily as their plumed, striped brethren. And sistren. The little spotted skunks don't seem to need to spray so much. So that was a part of the morning. I would have little adventures. One time I came down and there was one that had its arms around the honey pot and it had its little tongue in the hole at the top of the honey pot. Dana loves this story. She's always big on sanitation. And so we kind of looked at each other and, uh-oh, I did something. Sorry, I get excited. So, you know, we both went, ah! you know, and it ran away. And then another one that was really exciting was when I was dumping the coffee filter with the coffee, used coffee grounds in it, into the compost bucket. I opened it up and there was a little skunk inside the compost bucket. And so I literally out loud went, ooh, and it went, ooh, you know. So I dumped the bucket and it scooted away. So, you know, there I am right away in the, having these adventures before it's even time to go to the Zendo. So then I would drink my coffee and then put on my robe and actually put on my underrobe and carry my overrobe because you put it on after you've sat a while. And then there would be an hour-long period of Zazen, 10 minutes of walking, and then a 40-minute period of Zazen, and then about 45 minutes of service, chanting, bowing, formal breakfast in the Zendo with the meal, bowing and receiving for every single dish, chanting and eating. And then after that was when my schedule deviated a bit from the rest of the monks. The rest of the monks, for the rest of the day, you have a study hall, and then you have more Zazen, and then you have a work period and a break. I worked in the kitchen, so I sat less Zazen. After the breakfast, I would go to work, and I worked through dinner, except for a nice 3-hour break in the middle of the day, and then I would go to evening Zazen. So even though people often say, oh, in the kitchen you don't really get to sit very much, for me an average of 2.5 hours a day of Zazen is it's enough. It's good. It's a lot of Zazen. I really got to work with Zazen. And the other monks sat more. I say I, but it was actually we. I was one of a crew. There's the head cook, myself, and then there was a crew of five. He, Kim, Danny, Ryan, four, me, and Michael, the Tenzo. So we were a cohort. We were a sangha. We were a sangha within a sangha. We produced the food for the community every day. That was my Zendo. One of my big Zendos was the kitchen. And I'd be very happy to talk about kitchen practice if you want during the question time. But at this point, I want to talk a little more about Zazen before I talk about the kitchen practice.
How many people were there?
There were 49 to start, and we lost a few as we went. No, they didn't die or anything. They had it was a combination of previously arranged things they had to do and then a couple of family emergencies. So I think there were about 3 people who didn't stay the whole time. So we were a small crew. Usually there's 5 people and the cook and my role. I was the fukuten, which is basically the assistant to the tenzo, the person who manages the work in the kitchen. So the head cook plans all the meals, writes out all the instructions, the chop sheets. My job is to turn that into, you know, managing the labor and turning that into the food delivered on time, you know, 3 times a day. It was great. It was beautiful. I am so grateful for having been able to practice in that kitchen with those people. It was absolutely beautiful experience. But why I want to talk first about Zazen, it's probably easier for me to ramble on about the kitchen and the beautiful mountains. Oh, yeah, my 3-hour break during the day, what would I do? Well, some of the time I would just hit the hay and wouldn't even open my eyes for 2 hours. I was so exhausted. You know, I would wake up drooling on the pillow. Where am I? You know, that kind of exhaustion. So I was able to sleep in the day, which was really great. And I hiked a lot every day. I was out there in the mountains, hiking alone, up the big mountains, down the mountains, you know. That was fantastic. And then every day in the hot springs, my friends, every day in the sacred water. So that was really good. But now Zazen. Why do I want to talk about Zazen? Because it was really, really, really important for me to, now I know we're not supposed to have goals, but by gum, I had a goal. And I just felt like I need to settle my relationship with Zazen. In this mind and this body, I need to settle with Zazen. For some people, Zazen comes easy. For some people, it's an immediate joy and refuge and delight. And I'm not one of those people. And mind you, I'm a lifer. I'm in this for life. You know, it's Soto Zen that I'm in. I'm not looking for some other kind of Zen. Soto Zen is my path. And I've always known that from when I first discovered it. And, you know, I love studying, I love service, I love the Sangha, I love all these things. And the Zazen, it was always like, oh God, okay, I guess I need to do that. Because, as Dogen, our illustrious founder, says, and I brought some of his chants, one of the ones I'll be referring to is called the Self-Receiving and Employing Samadhi. It's one of the parts, the earliest writings that he wrote to encourage his students. And he just puts it right out there. And he says, now all ancestors and all Buddhas who uphold Buddha Dharma have made it the true path of enlightenment to sit upright, practicing in the midst of self-fulfilling samadhi. Those who attained enlightenment in India and China followed this way. It was done so because teachers and disciples personally transmitted this excellent method as the essence of the teaching. In the authentic tradition of our teaching, it is said that this directly transmitted, straightforward Buddha Dharma is the unsurpassable of the unsurpassable. There it is. You know, you just gotta do Zazen if you're in this school. But I wanted to, like, well, unsurpassable of the unsurpassable. Oh. So I just felt this real commitment. Like, I, you know, maybe, and this may sound really, 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 like, completely presumptuous, but, you know, I was thinking, you know, when Shakyamuni Buddha, when he sat down finally and said, I'm not getting up from this tree until I figure this thing out, you know? And basically, that was what gave us all Buddha's teachings, was that he was willing to sit down and not get up until he had some kind of insight. And I kind of felt like that. This is my third time going up there. You know, my last talk I opened by saying, the last time I went to Tassajara, I swore I would never go back. Why am I going back? And I gave this talk about why I thought I was going back, you know. So I was like, okay, you're going back. You're going back. So take this seriously. I turned 60 a few days after I got back. How many of you have turned 60? Let's see the hands. I don't know what your experiences were, but for me, I was like, no, this is it. This is for real now, kids. You know, you're 60. This is it. That don't waste time, you know. I mean, your peers start dying, you know, when you're 60. We all, you know, people younger than us. And you go, whatever it is that I feel like I need to do on this planet, I want to be doing it. And if Zazen is the unsurpassable of the unsurpassable in my school, I need to somehow settle. And I think that one of the things that was helpful was I finally stopped trying to be somebody else. And I stopped trying to sit Zazen the way I thought I was supposed to sit, or the way I thought the people here who really sit good Zazen, oh, I'll, you know, one of whom I live with, you know, so. You know, my, and Patrick, you know, I mean, Koki, I mean, they love Zazen, you know. God. And I finally realized I'm only going to be able to settle if I do it with the mind and body that I've got. So what is that? So it was kind of more of an inquiry. It became more of an inquiry than, I'm not doing it right and I better beat myself up again because somehow I think that's going to help me sit better Zazen. Like, after doing that for 25 years, you kind of start going, maybe let's try a different approach here. And I was very happy to have conversations with the abbess who was teaching, Christina Lehrer, the outgoing abbess, but she was the leader of the practice period. And she used this term, and when she, it was really helpful for me, and then I realized it's all over Dogen. And I had never really paid attention to it before. And it's this thing called negotiating the way. And I want to read you what Dogen says about negotiating the way. And where did I put? There it is. I've got all these little tabs with all my little numbers. But now I have to know where they are. There it is. Okay. So this is in his other really, really helpful teaching about Zazen, which is the first thing he wrote when he came back from China, Fukan Zazengi, which are his Zazen instructions. And I cannot recommend highly enough to the people who are beginners and to the people who are not beginners to study the Fukan Zazengi and the self-fulfilling samadhi. I mean, it's all there. It's all there. This teaching, the practice of Zazen, it's all there. So he uses this term here, although it is said that there are as many minds as there are persons, still they all negotiate the way solely in Zazen. So I had this sense of, this commitment that I have to somehow what I'm calling settle with this mind and body in Zazen, this is me negotiating the way. And all of us, this is the invitation that is being offered to us in this school that emphasizes this form of sitting. And of course, you know, by sitting, I mean a lot of us, we do this upright sitting, but it can also be done, if one cannot do upright sitting, it can be done lying down. It can be done standing. You know, it's the act of stilling the body, stopping the activity and stilling the body. That's the posture. And so if we can do this seated posture, we do. But when I say sitting, I mean metaphorically, you know, the act of resting on the earth, stopping the external activity. And again, as Dogen says, very literally, cease from practice based on intellectual understanding, pursuing words, and following after speech, and learn the backward step that turns your light inwardly to illuminate yourself. Mm-hmm. So this is the stopping, ceasing our practice based on trying to understand it with our intellect, pursuing words and following after speech, and actually learn the backward step, settling into this one. So when I talk about my experience here of settling into my relationship with Zazen, I'm talking about this one's experience. And I'm not suggesting that what I say you should do, but what I am hoping to encourage you to do is, what's your path of negotiating your way with your mind and your body in this act of stopping, settling, turning the light inward, and practicing Zazen, which is unique to each and every person. And again, from his beautiful teaching. Okay, now this one, here it is. This is great. This is from Self-Employing Samadhi. It's actually the closing line. This practice of negotiating the way that you're doing, nobody could tell you how to do it. And nobody can tell you whether or not you're doing it right, because it is a completely unique and individual experience. And Dogen says, know that even if all Buddhas of the 10 directions, as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, exert their strength, and with the Buddha's wisdom try to measure the merit of one person's Zazen, they will not be able to fully comprehend it. I want to read that again. Know that even if all Buddhas of the 10 directions, as innumerable as the sands of the Ganges, exert their strength, and with the Buddha's wisdom try to measure the merit of one person's zazen, they will not be able to fully comprehend it. And I think that's probably why in this school there tends not to be very much instruction given about what to do. You get a lot of instruction about how to enter the zendo, how to get onto your cushion, how to position your hands, where to put your tongue, you know, and all that. But once it gets quiet and that bell rings and it's silent, it's like you're on your own, right? Which in a way can be really not helpful, and I want to talk about that because, you know, if you're a person who has trouble with zazen, you can like flail around for 20 years before you have any samadhi at all, and that's kind of a drag. But it's also kind of cool because it really is honoring, I think, this teaching that, you know, even the Buddhas of the 10 directions and all the sands in the Ganges can't comprehend your zazen. So that said, that's kind of a big disclaimer in a way for that what I'm going to say is really just some personal sharing. And the reason I want to talk about some specific things is because I guess I kind of did wish that I had got a few more stepping stones along the way for the last 25 years, and so I want to just put it out there, share some of my stepping stones. And if this is blasphemy, I am sorry. Soto Zen fundamental. There are schools of Buddhism where they do give you some stepping stones, and I think sometimes it's nice to have some stepping stones. So I want to share a few of my stepping stones that I worked with up at Tassajara. Some of us, I think, who struggle with zazen, for some people there's physical difficulty. How many people here experience some range of physical discomfort when you sit? Yeah. For how many people sometimes does it have you not want to sit zazen? Yeah. Notice that Jean raised his hand. I just want to point that out. Okay. And, so let me put you on the spot then, Sensei. But you sit every day. So how do you negotiate the way with a body that sometimes has so much discomfort that it makes you not want to sit?
But you say that I love zazen, it's true. And that doesn't mean it's always delightful. Sometimes, and sometimes not. But I come every day, not because I love zazen, but because I love you all. Mm-hmm. And I need it to be supportive for the community.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, actually, when Christina was talking with us about following the schedule, which is one of the big challenges up at Tassajara, you know, the schedule, I mean, it starts getting really relentless. You know, no matter who you are, at some point, you're like, I just can't do it. I can't go sit another period of zazen. I just can't get up this morning. I just can't go back this evening and sit two more periods. You know, it's too much. And you work with that, you practice with that. Obviously, you know, if you're sick, you don't go, but they do have this thing where, you know, if you really don't want to go, you just sign out and say you're not going. And, you know, if you don't go and you don't sign out, they come and find out what's going on. But it's not like, you know, they drag you there kicking and screaming and force you to sit zazen. I mean, you know, it's intended to be a support. So when she was talking about, you know, the schedule, I mean, that practicing for others is, I think, part of the big schema of what we're doing, where, you know, what she said was, you know, of course, you take care of yourself if you can't come. And please know that we miss you. When your seat is empty, I notice it. Every morning, she'd say, when I go around and I do the morning Jundo, I know who's not here. And we're one body, and we feel it when part of the body isn't here. So I appreciate you bringing that, that part in, where love of Zazen, love of Sangha, love of the triple treasure, really, love of Buddha, love of Dharma, love of Sangha, that, you know, we have these bigger motivations sometimes than what our comfort end is, right? So certainly sometimes it's physical, sometimes it's the mind that gets in the way. How many people here have issues of your mind that get in the way of resting in your Zazen? And for how many people does that sometimes make you not want to sit Zazen? Yeah. Yeah. So for some of us, it's the body. For some of us, it's the mind. For some, it's both. For some lucky dogs, maybe it's neither. Anybody here really just don't? No, I'm not going to put in. So I'll put Jean on the spot, but I won't put. Okay. So for me, it's totally the mind. It's not that my body doesn't get tired, especially if I'm sitting long periods of Zazen, but by far the biggest suffering for me is what goes on up here. So that was really what I needed to work with. Because again, there too, Dogen has very, very simple and very clear instructions about what to do during Zazen with the mind, okay? And maybe some of you kind of know where I'm going with this. It's very, very simple, very clear instructions. He says, this is in his instructions for sitting Zazen. He's talked about how to get to your cushion and how you sit down and how to line up your nose and blah, blah, blah. And then he says, you know, once you've adjusted your posture, take a deep breath, inhale and exhale, rock the body right and left, settle into a steady, immovable sitting position. Think of non-thinking. How do you think of not thinking? No, excuse me. Think of not thinking. Right. How do you think of not thinking? It's going to be really helpful. Just you wait. Non-thinking. This in itself is the essential art of Zazen. That's it. Non-thinking. So that was like, I thought, okay, that's what I'm going to work with. Whenever I notice that I'm doing something other than non-thinking, I'm gonna try to true myself up. That's what I'm going to do to the best of my ability. That was what I practiced when I was sitting. And I think that, you know, sometimes there's what I would call maybe more, just it just needs a little nudge, and then you can return to a non-thinking place. You know, a little nudge, like, you know, the first step is you have to make, I mean, there is a basic step, which is to make the distinction of noticing what your mind is doing, rather than being so fully identified with it that you don't question it. You know, if you're at the place where you just think that what goes on in your head is the truth and you always have to listen to it, you got to work on that. You got to at least realize it's a radio station. It's not the truth, and you don't have to think it. Just because you think it, you don't have to think it. You know? So that's kind of step one. And you know, if you sit for any length of time, at some point you get kind of sick of what's going on up there and you start experimenting with, well, maybe I could try something else. Well, that's kind of the beginning of being able to have a little bit of say about what goes on with your precious mental facility, with our precious mental facility, that we are not just victims, helpless victims of, you know, monkey mind. So, you know, when you can notice it, if you can have some strategy for nudging it down, and calming to mind, that's great. And, you know, one of the real classic, fundamental, basic instructions, you know, count your breaths. That's a great instruction. You know, if you notice your mind is wandering, one, just count the breaths. Give the mind something else to do. Or just follow the breath. You don't even have to count. Just being aware, physically aware in the body of the sensation of the air coming in through the nostrils and filling the lungs and settling, and then the inhale and the exhale. So those are a couple of, you know, classic tried and true kind of settling the mind. For some people, some of us are word people, a little mantra might be helpful. So one of the ones I worked with there was Uchiyama Roshi's beautiful description of this, you know, action of non-thinking. He says, we can open the hand of thought. So sometimes I found that if the counting wasn't doing it and the following wasn't doing it, maybe if I just said to myself, oh, open the hand of thought. Open the hand of thought. So it's kind of giving the mind something else to think about until it relaxes, and then just allowing the non-thinking, just the present moment, samadhi, the merging of the subject and the object. Shikantaza, just sitting. But sometimes this one needs stronger interventions than those things. And there's the stronger interventions, I think, kind of on the kindness and compassion side, which can be generating positive thoughts, loving thoughts, you know, especially if I notice that the perseveration, the mental perseveration that is resisting, that doesn't want to be let go, that really wants to have a form, if I notice that it's got a bite to it, that it's either being critical of another or critical of this one, which is probably for me 75% of the radio station songs or some version of complaining about somebody else or criticizing myself. You know, and this is not traditional Soto Zen practice. It's more other Buddhist traditions where you actually introduce and use that energy but turn it. So if, for example, I'm thinking about a person on my kitchen crew who I was having some difficulty with because he didn't like to follow my directions and I was his boss and he liked to do things his own way and it would cause problems for me in my day if I was sitting there, you know, talking to him in my head and scolding him over and over and over and over, I could realize, oh, look at what I'm doing. This is me. He's not here. He's another person. This is me. This is my head. Is this really what I want to do with my precious Zazen time? Is this really what I want? I don't think so. Help. I need some help. I can't just stop doing it on my own. May, I'm going to call him Joe, you know, may Joe be happy. May Joe be happy. May Joe be free. May Joe be free from suffering. May Joe get to do it his way. May Joe find joy in doing it his way. May Joe experience liberation by getting to push up against his boss. I don't know, you know, whatever. But already you can feel how it shifts the energy. And especially if we're thinking really painful thoughts, it can be really important to shift the energy. Because one of the sad things, I mean, I hate to confess this to you, but it's very important and I want to say it. We can be so cruel to ourselves with the things that we think. And we're hurting ourselves when we do that. And I really became aware of, when I really paid attention there, sitting there for hours, noticing the content of some of the thinking, it was just, it's so sad, you know, that's what some ancient part of me thinks it's supposed to be doing with its time, is being cruel to myself or rehashing some problem I had with somebody 10 years ago, you know, which is, it's over. It's done. I'm the one who's being hurt by the perseveration of telling the story over and over again. I think it's this made-up person from 10 years ago, but they're gone. It's me. I'm hurting myself. Why would I want to hurt myself? So I really kind of took this on. No, I don't want to do that. So this cultivating compassion, cultivating generosity, can be a very transformational thing to do, where you can actually feel your body begin to relax. Finding the place in the body where the painful thought dwells is another way to practice with that. Rather than staying spinning in the content and telling the story and spinning the content, okay, let's just take a breath here. Now, where is this in my body? And you start noticing, and you start finding those little knots, the clenched jaw, the tight shoulders, the stomach knot. You know, can I put some breath, some energy, some kindness, some compassion literally into my body and nurture and comfort and ease up suffering, my suffering? And funny thing, you know, when you do this with your own suffering, guess what happens when you leave the zendo and you start encountering the others in your world? You know, if I could sit there and wish well to my little rascal team member, and then we were working together, and I saw him, I just had a much different response to him. I didn't need to be the big, heavy, you know. I didn't. I could still deliver the correction if I needed to, but it was from a very different mind and a very different heart. And we connected. We became very, very close, he and I. And we learned to talk about our dance of authority and resistance of authority. It was transformational for both of us. So I would say I need to start wrapping this up here, this part. I want to say two more things. So that's kind of the kind and compassionate, but there's also, I think, the kind of pull the plug. That was the phrase I came up with. Enough coddling, enough compassion, enough petting, enough cuddling. It's like, just stop it. Just pull the plug. Just pull the plug. Just pull it. Pull it. That worked too. Sometimes you have to get kind of tough with yourself. So that was good. And then the other one, and this is the last thing I want to say. I mean, I have a lot more I could say, but I want to really make sure that we talk about what you want to talk about. The other piece, though, that I want to talk about was a new discovery for me up there. I had never really brought this into the Zazen practice, but I was so committed to my vow that I really wanted to do my best to think non-thinking, that when I got kind of like really desperate with it, I just opened up for help and asked for help. And I want to read you a couple of the kinds of things that I... opening up to that which is larger than the small self. Now, again, Dogen does point this out, that this is a strategy that we can use. See, he's got it all in these teachings. So he talks about, in self-receiving and employing samadhi, just a minute, where is that? Excuse me. Here it is. Okay. Okay, he says, it's a little bit long, but I think it's really good. Opening up, so what I'm saying is my final strategy I'll talk about is opening up to that which is larger than your small self. So he says, because earth, grass, trees, walls, tiles, and pebbles all engage in Buddha activity, those who receive the benefit of wind and water caused by them are inconceivably helped by the Buddha's guidance, splendid and unthinkable, and awaken intimately to themselves. And a little later he says, grass, trees, and lands which are embraced by this teaching together radiate a great light and endlessly expound the inconceivable profound Dharma. Grass, trees, and walls bring forth the teaching for all beings, common people as well as sages. So I thought, well, that's pretty clear. And there were the big old mountains. So when I needed to, I called to the big old mountains for help. I just asked them for help out loud, out there in the mountains. And I called it my prayers. I said, I'm just going to call them prayers. This is prayers. So I'll read you a couple of them. And then I'll see if there's someplace you would like to go. So. Oh, and then I have to read that one. Okay, so here's a couple of the prayers that I wrote to support my goal of somehow settling my relationship with Zazen. Oh, please, mountains and rivers, take me outside of my feverish little clod of self-concern. Let my heart mind extend out to touch and be touched by the big bones of these furry ridges, the embrace of the morning sun. Please help me massage out my mental and emotional kinks so my energy can flow out and nourish others. And then I would just use the words of the sutras themselves. Another one I wrote was, may I settle into my Zazen as the being that I am, with all of my twitches and yearning for sleep and movement and freedom. May I somehow, with the assistance of grass, trees, and walls, and Buddha's guidance, leap beyond the walls of my mind. May I turn the great Dharma wheel and let myself be turned by this broad awakening. And those are just lines from Dogen's Sutra. So I think that's another source for those who might find sometimes, if you need some encouragement, is take the sutras and take some part of the sutra and bring it into your own body mind and let it support you. I think that's why he wrote it. I really do. So I'll leave you with this, and it is just 7:25. Oh boy, that clock sure moves fast. I want to just read this one more because this makes me laugh. These are just things from my journal. So, I have this persistent experience when I sit down on my cushion. No matter whether I have a good period or a bad period, whether I'm practicing the six gates or scanning my chakras or chanting the Metta Sutta, whether I have obsessive conversations with imaginary beings or plan my dining room remodel or listen to the creek or the blue jays or do shikantaza, time just passes at its tick-tock pace, no faster or no slower for my thinking or non-thinking. And of course, the big Zen joke is that this time doesn't even really exist. It's just me living my life, breath after breath, and that's it. That's all. So, we do have some time, and I'd love to entertain any questions, or if there's anything you'd like to know more about or anything. I'm so glad I didn't get into a coughing fit, and I'm glad you didn't get into a coughing fit. You didn't have to leave. So, any? Yes?
In your drift into non-thinking, does that lead to sleeping?
You know, I am a person who doesn't go to sleepiness. I don't sleep in Zazen. I know people who do, and they say it's a kind of a curse. I usually wish I could sleep because I'd catch up on my sleep, but I don't go to sleep. I mean, sometimes if I'm like really exhausted, then, you know, I might find myself, but the non-thinking for me doesn't go to sleepiness. Does it for you? Yeah. So you probably would develop another little set of strategies of waking up again. Ah, yeah, it's tricky, isn't it? So that's your negotiation of the way is, how can I do this non-thinking without sleeping and without thinking about it? That's a great little koan to practice with. I look forward to hearing about what you learn. Yes?
Along that same line, did you ever wake up directly in that state of mental health? And if you did, how did you cultivate that throughout the day?
You mean did I ever wake up like in waking out of sleep into that? That to me is one of the sweet, delicious things that when that happens, I'm so thankful. And it did and does sometimes happen. And in fact, I had this period where I was having these mid-morning dreams that were really amazing. And I started trying to play around with my schedule so that I could allow myself to have sleep at that time so I could wake in this very lucid state. I just kind of consider that a gift when that happens. I always aspire to try to sustain it, but I'm just, such is the nature of my delusion that I think I'm getting a little better at it at age 60, but it's still a kind of an uphill battle for me because I just have such a restless mind. Or I have had such a restless mind. I don't know, we'll see. I mean, I definitely have felt a lot more, a lot less bothered since I've come back from Tassajara. And it, but it's 20 days, so, you know, we'll see. Yes.
Are you going back?
You know, that is so funny. That is so funny because, you know, not that I'm planning on it, but I actually would now. I actually think I don't think I have that fear anymore. That I had.
What was the fear of?
The difficulty of it.
But you did it three times with the fear and then...
No, the first time it wasn't so scary. It was kind of exciting. Mm-hmm. The second time it was a hard time in my life. It was like the worst, one of the worst times in my life. And it was just, it's not an easy place to be if you have a lot of emotional and or physical relational stuff going on. It's not an easy place to be because, you know, it's really a pretty relentless schedule. And it's not about you and it's not about your feelings. It's about following the schedule. Mm-hmm. So it was hard, I think, because of that. And I was also not so sure about Zen. I had just gotten ordained, and I don't know how common this is that right after you get ordained you have big doubt about what the heck you think you're doing, but I did, you know. And so this time, I guess it just felt so much more settled that, you know, once I cracked the coffee thing in the morning and figured out how to get up early, and I don't know, just the attitude. I think my attitude was part of it, that I was just really clear that, no, I want to do this, and I'm committed to this, and it's a good thing that I'm here. And even when I had a few bumps in the road up there, when I really trued myself up, I went, no, this is the right thing for me to be doing right now. It just is. So I kind of trust that if there ever was another such time, that I wouldn't be afraid of it. But I'm not planning for any... I mean, I'm really glad to be back. Well, to the extent that you start having a little more equanimity in general, it helps. Yeah.
I was excited that you said you would talk a little bit, maybe perhaps, about your kitchen experience.
Yeah.
Maybe to focus it a little bit in terms of the question, is there any particular thing about your work in the kitchen that you found you brought back to your own kitchen? Or a new way of approaching.
Oh yeah.
In the kitchen or something.
What I should ask Jean to answer that. No.
She's always been the kitchen boss.
Yeah, but I have more. But now I have all these little containers. I learned about advanced prep. advanced prep. It's just the cat's meow. I mean, you know, you do all your chopping like all at once, and for all your different things you're going to do, and you pre-cook stuff, and you put them all in these little, you know, containers, and then when you cook, you don't have to also chop and grate and all that. It's there, so you just cook, and it really transforms the experience of cooking and feeling like you can really kind of produce things to separate the, you know, not always, not as a hard and fast rule, but I mean as a practice. I am aware that it's 7:33, and what is the, like, I'm kind of, who should I look to? What's the kind of like cutoff time here? Like now? Okay. So if you want to hear more about kitchen practice, come and have tea, and I would be more than happy to share more about specific kinds of questions that you have about kitchen practice or anything else that you might want to talk more about. And you can always grab me and ask me anytime about any of this. Thank you so much all for coming. I can't tell you how beautiful it is to see all of you here and be with you. There's nothing like having a home sangha. It's a real treasure. So thank you. Yeah.